High School Slumber Party is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage Club related, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
School is out and it's Friday night. I'm all wrapped up and I feel alright.
Welcome, activists, high school rock musicians, and of course, queens, prime ministers, and princesses. This is High School Slumber Party, the podcast where you and some friends look back at their teenage years through the lens of some iconic high school-centric films. I'm Brian Rodriguez, and the party's at my place this evening. But first, despite us being at home, school is still in session. We have some homework to chat about.
This was your assignment, and I would like to see the results.
Hope all of you are staying safe and healthy, and of course, as always, these days, and maybe, you know, for a good long while we'll be doing this, but a salute to our healthcare heroes out there. Thank you for keeping us safe. But of course, this is High School Slumber Party, and you had some homework. The first homework being listening to Monday's episode, as we're bi-weekly now. It was on Beavis and Butthead Do America, and my good friends Dan and Autumn Ferrara were the guests. It was an awesome movie. It was an awesome chat with them. And it was so nice learning that they had their baby. So congratulations to them, and we salute you, young Harrison, and hopefully you'll be listening to High School Slumber Party very, very soon. Of course, you had your homework for this week, and we'll get into that in a second. But first, wherever you're listening to us now, whether that be Spotify, whether that be Google Play, whether that be Stitcher, whether that be Apple Podcasts, make sure you subscribe to High School Slumber Party. And if you can, give us a 5-star rating. And if you can, give us a nice little positive review. And if you can't do that, or you've done it already, the best way you could help High School Slumber Party is by telling a friend about all the wonderful things we do here every week for the free price of free dollars and free cents. Check us out again Friday and Monday on the Cage Club Podcast Network. That's cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me, the home of so many other great shows. I've been a guest on a couple of them recently. I was recently a guest on Foodie Films a couple times, but I think this week I was on The Founder. And coming up, I'm going to be on our hottest show, Too Fast, Too Forever, the Fast and Furious podcast, hosted by the godfather himself, Joey Lewandowski, and our lifetime man, Joe Too. It's a great show. You want to check that out as well. Whoa, whoa, whoa! The bell doesn't dismiss you. I dismiss you. Why can't you get it through your heads? I brought the bell home with me, guys. This continues. And we still have this week's homework to chat about. You don't remember what it was? Shame on you. It was to watch The Princess Diaries, a royal and elegant Disney film, which I had a blast watching with my good friend all the way from Australia, Shawnee Mead. I met Shawnee, of course, through social media on Twitter, because she does her homework. She participates. She participates the easiest way you can. Social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or email me at highschoolslumberparty@gmail.com. highschoolslumberparty@gmail.com. Class participation is a huge part of your grade. But without further ado, let's get to princess talk, shall we? I leave you with a song from the film. I consider this the main song, right? Because it plays at the end. Makes sense. And the song is Myra, Miracles Happen. So, put on your favorite jammies, tell your mother you're going to have a audio slumber party with Brian, because we're about to get our party on. Class dismissed.
Myra,
Welcome back, Shawnee. You haven't been on since Harry Potter.
I know, it's been a while.
Happy to have you back during, you know, our quarantine times. But it's not much different for you and I, because we've always spoke this way and not in person.
You know, we're used to this of communicating by the internet. It's just weird to do that with people in our own country or in our own state.
Yeah, family members and such. But, you know, we have a fun one today. We have a familiar one, at least for me, and I think for you.
Yeah.
As well, and that's The Princess Diaries 2001. And, you know, before we get into that, remember, we introduce ourselves a certain way on High School Slumber Party, and why don't you go ahead and do that?
All right. Well, hi, everyone. I'm back again. Shawnee, I graduated in 2007 from Oakbank Area School, but yeah, we don't have a mascot, but we've talked about that before.
Yes, no mascots in Australia, but, you know, still some good times and still a fun enjoyment of high school movies.
Yeah.
And this is surprisingly more of a high school movie than I even remembered. I knew she was obviously in high school, but there are actually a decent amount of high school scenes here.
Yeah, and skip over school in films. There's like a tiny bit of school, and then the rest. Mm-hmm. This is pretty much half school, half princess lessons. So.
Yeah, which, like you said, I wrote that down. There are lessons, too. So it's not like when we're at a school, we kind of have like a school vibe to it as well.
Yeah.
Of course, though, every week I read back at the DVD, back at VHS, and you actually provided me with your own today because you own the dual copy of the original and the sequel.
Yes, because it was cheaper than buying the two of them separately. So.
Let me read it now. Disney's The Princess Diaries, a hilarious, hip, and heartwarming modern-day Cinderella story. Mia, a shy and gawky teenager who survives each day of school with minimum attention, discovers a shocking news that she's a real-life princess. Funny and uplifting. Your entire family will thoroughly enjoy this crown jewel.
Sums it up well, I suppose.
You know, we do have some background on this film because it was actually a surprise hit when it came out. But first, I want to know your background on the film. What's your history with The Princess Diaries?
Well, it came out when I was 11. So I still haven't actually discussed a film with you that I watched when I was a teenager. I'm working my way up to it.
Close.
Because I mean, Harry Potter, but to me, that's more fantasy rather than high school. But an actual high school film, but I'm getting there. I'm getting closer. I'm like 2 years away now. Yeah, well, first of all, yeah, I'd read some of the books first because I think the first like two or three were out by the time this movie was made, I think, or maybe more, I think. So I was already really familiar with the story. So I was very excited that this was coming out. Obviously, when it came out, it was definitely for me. I was like the target audience because it was not that I ever wanted to be a princess myself, but but yeah, I was already familiar with the whole world of the movie. So I was, you know, really excited when it came out, and I loved it when it came out. I mean, I hadn't seen any Gary Marshall films yet, obviously, but now I've seen all of his rom-coms, and even it has like a funny sort of Gary Marshall rom-com vibe, even though it's for teens, but it's still got a lot of his like fun, pratfall kind of stuff.
Absolutely. He's one of the reasons that I think this film was a success. Before that, quickly, you mentioned the princess thing. It's kind of weird, right? Like, at least in the United States, princess stories are very common. This is a Disney film. They're a princess factory. We don't have, like, royalty in the U.S., so I always found it kind of odd. But this is very clearly Disney's The Princess Diaries. They make that clear. I think it's on, like, the DVDs and all the posters. It's not just, like, The Princess Diaries, and it happens to be produced by Disney. Now, like, Mia's not, like, a Disney princess in the traditional sense, but it comes from a long line of making princess films.
Yes, definitely.
I assume in Australia, same kind of princess popularity?
Yeah, it's sort of similar because, I mean, we don't technically have any royalty. We sort of officially sort of, but it's not like we associate with, I don't think of the queen as being like, you know, my queen or anything. So I kind of,
ooh.
I always feel like Americans are a bit more excited about it. We're kind of like, yeah, royalty, whatever. But we're excited when we had our own princess. You know, it's Mary, the future queen of Denmark, that kind of thing. That was exciting. But yeah, I think we're kind of, I mean, we watched the royal weddings and we watched the Harry Meghan Markle one, but you know, we're not all that excited about that. But
I mean, I'm not really one who's like into the royal thing, but certainly there is that, again, huge tradition and huge Disney tradition. And I'm happy that you read the books, because when I first saw this film, I wasn't in a theater, but it was when it came out on like DVD, VHS, or whatever, as this film, like I said, got very popular. And it wasn't really for me in terms of, not that I didn't enjoy it, but
yeah.
2001 was my freshman year of high school, so I might have just been 8th grade or freshman, not too sure. But, you know, whenever it came out, I was around that age. I don't think I was the target demographic, frankly. But I have a lot of younger cousins and younger siblings. Like, I'm the oldest grandchild on my mom's side. So I saw this film a lot. And I didn't hate it either. But it seems like, a lot of people around my age and, you know, within like a 5 year, 5 to 8 year span down, all saw this film. It was really, really big for the time. And I was excited to see it again because I hadn't really seen it in a while. And you mentioned they're based on books by Meg Cabot. Now, one of the big differences that you probably are aware of, but they were moved from New York, which they're set in the books, to San Francisco.
Yes.
San Francisco plays a big part in this movie. It's not just like a setting change.
I keep mentioning the hills.
The hills, the trolleys.
The trolleys, the San Francisco-ness of it all.
Yeah, certain neighborhoods they talk about, streets. So
yeah.
They made that change. Just a little background on the book for you guys listening out there. Even early on, it was like, wow, this is movie-worthy. You know, I read this online. Meg Cabot's agent tried to sell the movie rights very early on. Disney bit, but they didn't really have a lot of faith in the project. Not that they thought it would do bad. They're obviously not going to finance anything that would lose money. Mm-hmm. But it was also something where, you know, they didn't like build their whole movie season around it either.
Yeah.
The original title of the script was The Princess of Tribeca.
Mm.
But Tribeca is a neighborhood in Manhattan. And when you move it to San Francisco, that obviously doesn't make sense.
No.
So when they started producing the movie, the lead producer was Deborah Martin Chase. And I mentioned her because she's actually pretty historic, because she's the first Black female producer to ever have a studio deal. And this was, again, a huge hit for her. Whitney Houston's also like a producer, which is funny.
I never had noticed that before. I think because when I was 11, I mean, I knew who she was, but I didn't notice the credits. But I read on BuzzFeed like a couple of years ago and I went, what? And then I went, there it is. It's just like, it's not like they were hiding it. It's clearly there going, produced by Whitney Houston. But I was like, oh.
Yeah, when you're a kid, you don't really read the credits, but that was so interesting. You mentioned Gary Marshall, and again, huge part of the success of this film is Gary Marshall, who signed on to this project. You hit the nail right on the head. You know, Gary Marshall, so many things. I mean, Pretty Women. He really put his stamp on this movie. And I don't know, with another director, this might be like, and I'm not dissing this, but this might be like streaming movie quality or like made for TV movie quality.
But it definitely made it, you know, cinematic quality, because he was bringing all of his, you know, amazing skill and all of his people, because every Gary Marshall film has like all of those background people, and like they're always in all of them all the time.
Yeah, yeah. He really makes his films a family affair. You know, we lost him a couple years ago, but I don't know if he gets enough credit, because he's not like an auteur kind of director. He's not like, you know, making like fancy Oscar kind of things, but he certainly has like a very interesting catalog that I think, you know, I'd argue is underappreciated.
It's not all Valentine's Day and Mother's Day and whatever all those.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if we want to talk about the end of his career too much. I hate to say it, but yeah. You mentioned Valentine's Day, New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
What's the other one? Oh, Mother's Day. Oh my God. Yes.
Julia Roberts had a really bad wig, but that put me off.
He's done a couple Julia Roberts films, right? Besides Pretty Women and that one?
Because Runaway Bride as well.
Runaway Bride.
Julia Roberts and Richard Gere, you know, later to have another, you know, rom-com together.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's good at what he does, but maybe it went too far. I don't know. This is not a Gary Marshall podcast. He certainly kicked ass here in The Princess Diaries. So, the other huge factor, and to me, that made this film stand out and made it the hit it was the cast and just the acting overall. I mean, let's start with Julie Andrews here. Just to pull Julie Andrews out of semi-retirement, essentially, in a Disney movie? She hadn't done a Disney movie since Mary Poppins.
Well, she's practically perfect in every way, so it was good to bring her back. She might not actually be royalty, but, you know, let's face it. She is the queen of our hearts, because, you know, we all love a bit of Julie Andrews.
And that's what's amazing. You know, you say something really cool there that, like, even though she's not really a queen, like you said, she is a queen to anyone who's ever watched, like, a family movie because,
yeah.
You know, again, Mary Poppins, Sound of Music, just her ability to just add gravitas to this role. And,
yeah.
You know, if you're going to add, like, some real heavyweight power on a queen role,
who else would it be unless it was, you know, Helen Mirren? Like, it's, you know, those two, they have to be the queen.
But I would argue that Julie Andrews in this role is even better than Helen Mirren, because Helen Mirren, you know, acting, she's doing her thing, but she doesn't have the Disney legacy,
yeah,
really, that Julie Andrews has. Right away, I even remember being a kid and being like, what? Julie Andrews in this film?
Mm.
And it didn't feel like one of those things where they bring, like, an actor who's semi-retired back for, like, a dumb role. Like, okay, I'll be a little bit more blunt. It didn't feel like she just took this to collect a paycheck, you know?
She was definitely, you know, coming back because she wanted to do the project. And, yeah, I just think she's perfect in that role because she has, like, a really big role. She's definitely, like, the equal lead, I would say, in the film.
Again, I didn't read the books. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. But apparently, like, the grandmother character was a little bit nicer in the books.
No, it was actually the other way around.
Okay.
Andrews is, like, this wonderful, lovely grandmother that everyone would want her to be a grandmother. But in the books, she's, like, this kind of scary lady. And she has, like, tattooed on.
Gotcha.
Eyeliner and drinks a lot of whiskey, and she has, like, a creepy little dog all the time. Like, she's just, like, really mean, and they kind of don't really get on that well because she's just really, like, mean and demanding. So in this, she's sort of, you know, this lovely queen lady who's very grandmotherly, but she's not like that in the book at all.
Okay, I was gonna ask, because it's like, what are these books like if that's the case? Okay, that makes a lot more sense. And of course, she's a former Oscar winner, and found an interesting note that they shot this on the same stage that they shot Mary Poppins. So, like, the last Disney movie she did, and this one, same place. It's like, whoa, that's so cool. Of course, though, we can't talk about this film and not talk about the wonderful Anne Hathaway as Mia Thermopolis here.
I think this was her first movie, I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
A really good job, because she seems really natural, but she's, like, good at, she has, like, good comedic timing and is good at all the, like, funny prep fall kind of things, because they make her do a lot of awkward stuff, and she just takes to it so well.
She's amazing, especially, again, for her first role. So, a little background on this role, actually. It was originally offered to Juliette Lewis, which I can't picture now.
That's really, I can't even picture to do this move.
Well, she actually dropped out, and the studio was like, oh no, this is not good. So they bandied about all these names, and depending on where you read, most of them rejected it, or they just didn't get the role. But here's the list: Christina Applegate, Amanda Peet, Cameron Diaz, Alyssa Milano, Josie Davis, Kate Beckinsale, Tiffany Thiessen, Eva Mendes, Drew Barrymore, Reese Witherspoon, Alicia Silverstone, Sarah Michelle Gellar, Brittany Murphy, Katie Holmes, Jennifer Love Hewitt, Claire Danes, Kate Hudson, Christina Ricci, Jessica Alba, Jessica Biel, and Kirsten Dunst.
Some are a bit old.
Some of them are old. Some of them are around the same age.
Yeah.
The point is, though, they were all established. And originally, the studio wanted to go with an established name. Apparently, none of them were too particularly interested, so they did a whole new round of auditions, auditioning some unknowns along with some known actors. It ended up being a decision of, do we pick a name or do we go with a new person? And if they picked a name, they had decided that they would go with Liv Tyler.
Oh, okay.
Which, again, I can't picture.
I can't imagine Liv Tyler ever looking awkward and weird and, like, freakish.
Exactly. Like, Liv Tyler kind of grossly was in her father's music videos as a teenager as kind of, like, a sex object. We don't have to talk about that now, but it's It's creepy, but the transition to like dorky princess would not have gone over as well. At least that's how we see it now. Who knows? Maybe the movie would have been completely different. But then the unknown was Anne Hathaway. And Anne Hathaway, so this was the first movie of hers that was released, but apparently there was another film of hers that she technically shot before in New Zealand. And she auditioned for this on a layover from, I believe, New York or wherever she's from. She had a layover in LA. She auditioned for this, and then she went off to New Zealand to film this rando movie. But she was super awkward in the audition. She actually like tripped and fell in front of the director.
Oh, yeah, I did read that. And then they were like, it's you.
Yes. She said she related to Mia so much. Gary Marshall saw her and was like, this person's so perfect, apparently. And she didn't even have to do a screen test. She got the role. Once they decided they wanted to go with an unknown, she got the role completely based on that audition. I'm sure much to her surprise.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously she doesn't look freakish either. Like really, she's just got bushy eyebrows and curly hair. Like obviously it's Anne Hathaway, so she doesn't need much to like, you know, look gorgeous. But I mean,
no, no.
Maybe she just needed a brush or some different glasses or.
Yeah.
Like everyone acts like she's this massive, like, you know, freak, but she kind of is just awkward and has big hair.
So yeah, the hair was a wig that.
Yeah.
They called the Beast, I believe, because it was just so big on set. And the eyebrows took an hour every day to put in because each individual hair, what do they call, eyebrow hair, I guess, was glued there. But again, it's not, yeah, it must be crazy, but it wasn't too dramatic of a change. And look, she's a very, as you said, she's a very beautiful person. But she does have a certain awkwardness that I think it's so good. But ironically, Gary Marshall cast her because he thought that that final speech, which is a great speech, we'll talk about it, but that that final speech would be delivered so well from her that like she was gold for it. And he was so right.
Yeah, definitely.
She makes the movie and she was 17 when she shot this. So an actual teenager, not too much older than what her character is supposed to be, which is nice to see.
Yes, because it's very rare. Normally they're like, you know, at least 20.
And this movie is actually rated G, which it might be the first G-rated movie. And in the United States, I know they do ratings different by you. G is literally the most friendly rating you can get.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the first one above. I think there's another one that's usually like for documentaries about fish or something, but like.
Okay, yeah, maybe not that one, but like.
For like films, it's the like, you know, you can't go any more family friendly than that.
G movies don't do well. Even like Pixar movies are PG usually. Like, so this, again, big shock to everyone. And for her to just pull this lead role here and just kick ass like this is just, again, watching it now, I'm still mesmerized. I'm even more mesmerized because I guess I just didn't care as much. You know, when I'm watching it as a kid, it's just like, whatever.
She does an amazing job. She's like spot on Anne Hathaway, which I don't understand why so many people hate on Anne Hathaway. Like, I do not understand why that happened because I think Anne Hathaway is great. And she seems like a really great person as well.
Yeah, you can't count me as an Anne Hathaway hater. So many other people, again, would have made this movie pedestrian in their first acting role. One more note I had on her, that her father in the movies is actually played by her real life father.
Oh.
Now, I don't think his voice was like his letter voice, but like, you know, when you see the scene of him
writing,
composing the letter. Yeah, that's actually him. So I'm like, that's interesting.
So it's Mr. Hathaway, because oddly, she's named after Shakespeare's wife, so they're not actually the Hathaway family.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. It's funny, because her dad has the same last name, so maybe they all changed it?
Oh. When they kind of were naming her, they were like, we like the name Anne Hathaway, but I think her mother at least has a different name. I think it was something weird, but I don't think it's like a traditionally the family name or something.
Who knows? I just looked up her dad on Twitter. And it indeed is the guy in the movie. Gerald T. Hathaway, attorney with over 30 years experience. Hmm. Good to know if you want to hire him.
Yeah.
Free plug for Anne Hathaway's dad as your lawyer.
Nice.
So this next person I want to talk about is a guy I really like. And he's in actually all the Gary Marshall films, which I learned. And that's Hector Elizondo, who plays Joe.
Yes, he's great. I love Joe. And he's always great in all of the Gary Marshall films.
Yeah, he's an awesome actor. He's certainly underappreciated. One of the notes I wrote down is that in the script, there was no romance between the Queen and Joe at all.
They just subtly added that in?
Yeah, so during like some script readings, they noticed that they had a lot of chemistry together. And again, I'm going to kick it back to Gary Marshall. Gary Marshall's a kind of director who's like, wow, that works. Let's change things up a little. So he subtly added a lot of like scenes of chemistry. Now, there's never like love scenes between them or anything like that. And if you read the lines a completely different way and a lot of scenes, it wouldn't mean anything. But originally in the script, he's just like the faithful driver, you know? But there's definitely some tension, not tension in a negative way, but I mean, I don't want to call it sexual tension in a G movie, but
gently hint that even though she's been, obviously they have just really liked each other for a long time, but she's still kind of in mourning because of her husband's death and like her son's death and like, but subtly kind of, you know, you feel like eventually, you know, maybe when she's not the queen anymore or something, they'll, you know, which spoiler, they do in the sequel, they, you know, get married in the end.
Oh, again, so I haven't seen the sequel, so I definitely want you to tell me about that after.
But yeah, I like that it's just a little subtle, and I like that in a movie for teens, you've got a teen romance, but you also got, you know, a romance for an older couple, which is nice because a lot of movies don't focus on that, but like, that still happens.
Yeah. And it's funny you mention that because that was a big deal too. That was why they wanted to include it in there as well. So I'm glad that they were able to include it.
Mm.
So a couple other people I want to mention. Heather Matarazzo plays Lily, who's like Mia's best friend.
Terrible best friend. Whatever.
She's terrible, but they have really good chemistry in a sense. Yeah, she's not a good person. Well, I can't say that because she is like selfless in terms of like what she wants to do. Apparently, Anne Hathaway and her became very good friends during this filming, and they still keep in touch today. I wanted to bring her up as well because she's in another film we've covered on this podcast called Saved, and her co-star in Saved is the next person I'm going to mention, Mandy Moore.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but yeah, I did know they were both in that film.
Yeah, and Mandy Moore has like three films back to back to back, kind of teen films, I'll say. And there's one, I think there's one where she plays like the president's daughter, but I'm not counting that one.
No, I have, and then she like, yeah, runs away and has like a European holiday with some dude.
Yeah, I don't know if she's a teenager there or in college, so whatever, we'll ignore that one. But it's this, Walk to Remember, and Saved were all came out around the same time. And obviously she's more known. Well, I don't know what she's more known for these days, but at the time I think she was more known as a singer. But now maybe she's a little of both.
Yeah, because of that awful weepy show that she's on that I don't remember what it's called, but... I think,
oh yeah,
known for that at the moment. But
yeah, so she's certainly like a dual threat, I guess. I mean, I don't know if she has had like a new album in a while. This sounds like a Mandy Moore diss. That's not what I'm trying to do. Of course, you're talking about This Is Us in terms of the show, which I've never seen, but you're right. Everyone who watches that cries, so.
I just avoid that one. I don't have to talk about.
I feel like if you get into it, you really got to get into it.
Yeah, you can't just half watch it.
Yeah, you're not a casual This Is Us fan. Like, oh, I just pop in from time to time.
Oh, yeah, pop in on the tragedy.
You know, there's a couple other people who I recognize, but at least two more people I want to mention. Robert Schwartzman plays, what's his name? Michael, I guess, in the film?
Yeah, Lily's brother.
Yeah, Lily's brother. And this is his only major acting performance ever.
Yeah, non-Wes Anderson Schwartzman brother.
Yeah, I was going to say he's Jason Schwartzman's brother, Talia Shire's son.
Cousins of someone that maybe is well-known on this network.
Yeah.
Maybe Nicolas Cage?
Absolutely. He's a cousin of the flagship here. He's technically a Coppola, which makes him... not a Cage, but a Cage rip.
Royalty.
Absolutely. So he's in the Familia here. And he's the lead singer of the band, which was somewhat popular at the time, Rooney.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the band does appear in the movie, and they actually play a song from the band, but he really wanted to focus more on his music rather than his acting. That's why he didn't pursue it more. I liked Rooney in high school, so it was interesting, you know, that he was in this film, but even more, well, I don't want to know interesting, but even more fun in my life, his band played like a concert in the city maybe like a year or two ago. It's in New York, and I was like, let's go. So I went, and it was cool because I got to see him. And I was like, that's the dude from The Princess Diaries.
Oh my God, Michael from The Princess Diaries.
I don't know if you guys had this store Hollister in Australia, but I think it was owned by Abercrombie and Fitch, whatever, but it was like a kind of their like surf version.
We don't have it here, but I have been in to a store in Hawaii.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. And they used to play like a lot of like Rooney music and had like that vibe. And I can't listen to that band without thinking of that store. Let's just say like hearing that song really jogged some past time spent at the shopping mall. We'll put it that way. You know, there's other people in here who are recognizable, but I wanted to mention Sandra Oh is the vice principal, and Sandra Oh is like a really, really talented actor. I didn't remember that she was the vice principal.
I would say before she completely took off in television, Grey's Anatomy and, you know, Killing Eve and all of that, in just a very small role. I think she's really funny. Like,
yeah,
she brings a lot of like comedy to a very tiny role.
I remembered the vice principal. I just didn't realize it was her, just like the way she picked up the phone, like Gupta. She's fawning over the queen at that one point. Like, it's just so great. Yeah, she's amazing in this. Oh, I forgot to bring up Fat Louie, the cat. So apparently they had a lot of cats, and each cat would do a different thing, like go down to the floor, jump. One of the cats was actually Anne Hathaway's cat, so I guess they had to match the cats. I'm not sure how that happened. Maybe she adopted the cat during the filming, but thought that was cool.
I suppose they'll do that with babies. Like, they'll have, like, a sleeping baby, and then they'll have the baby that smiles and the baby that laughs. And they always seem to, like, have 4 or 5 babies because they're not let them wear very long because they're babies.
I thought you meant that Anne Hathaway, like, adopted a baby during a film or something. I was like, whoa, that...
The babies, they, like, have a lot of them on the payroll.
So that's the cast. Is there anyone else you want to mention in particular? Or?
That is all, I think.
Like Mandy Moore's boyfriend, I've seen him in like a couple other things. I can't remember off the top of my head. The mom played a big part here, but I hadn't really recognized her from anything. She was played by an actress named Carolyn Goodall or Goodell.
I think she's British. I think I've seen her in something else.
Okay. So let's get into it. Let's talk about some scenes. I'll just say off the bat, the first thing that surprised me is I didn't expect this movie to be like 2 hours long.
Yeah, it is actually quite long because I rewatched it just before this and I was like, the middle section just kind of, there's a lot happening.
So early on, we get a lot of, I don't know, like establishment of like who Mia is, right? Like, at least at the time, she's just like a kind of dorky teenager. Like you mentioned, she's got that huge hair. She's got those big eyebrows.
She wears docks all the time. She's like a bit, you know, but I think, yeah, from that, they're trying to go like, you know, she's got glasses and she's dorky. But she does have the coolest bedroom.
Well, they live in a very cool house.
Yeah.
I mean, which is an old firehouse.
Yeah, so she's got like an attic room and then like another bit of room. And then I think she's got like 3 bedrooms or like kind of crazy because she has the whole like top half of the house. And she has a pole to get down in the morning.
Yeah, it's an awesome pole. And it's very much, she doesn't strike me. Yeah, she's like a quote unquote dork, but she's not like someone who you wouldn't want to be, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
She lives in a cool place. Like, she seems to like have cool interests. There's like some really awesome like music posters. And I don't know if like I was like, wow, she's into Elliot Smith. I was kind of confused, but still, like, it's still pretty cool. Maybe that's Anne Hathaway who can bring that kind of coolness to the character. You know, early on, some things I noticed too that was like I was kind of surprised she'd be into a guy like Michael. Her mom's like this artist, and she seems to have cool interests. And she's not into Michael.
The stupid Maddie, stupid boyfriend with the stupid hair, John.
Yeah, so.
Who's like a total creep.
Yes. So she's into Josh, and I'm kind of surprised that she's into Josh. It doesn't seem like that's where her interest would lie, but you know what? Teenage girls, they have crushes. Who knows, right?
They have crushes on stupid popular dudes, which is, ugh.
We don't cover too many movies that are based at private school, so this was cool to see. The uniforms and all that. I liked her just like going to school with the Razor scooter and meeting up with her friends. It's very like sign of the times as well.
There'll be murder on all those hills.
Oh my god, yeah.
Ah.
And one of the big moments early on is when she has that debate against Mandy Moore, boyfriend, jerk guy.
Yeah, which is really awkward and comfortable, but all the popular people are being really mean. Like, they want to make fun of her hair, and they're just like, oh my god, she's so embarrassing. Like, you've had your debate, just let her do her thing. Obviously, she's just embarrassed.
Yeah, she gets sick, and again, it really just sets up who the character is. I think it does a really great job at that, too.
And then they have that bit that she's just sitting, like, out in the courtyard at school, and then someone sits on her, and then she, like, somebody sat on me again. It seems really awful, because she seems like she has this really cool life outside of school, and she seems really confident, you know, with her friends and her family and her rock climbing friends, which randomly she works on rock climbing place.
Does her mom own that place? Is that what it is? Or does her mom work there too? I'm like kind of confused, but...
I felt like Mia worked there, but maybe they let her.
But the mom shows up a couple times. Maybe. I don't know. It's not something I really remember. What I like about this movie in terms of my watch is that, like, there's things that really stuck with me throughout the years, and there's things that I guess didn't. The rock climbing stuff definitely did not.
It does introduce the idea of the grandmother coming, which seems like a weird scene, but yeah.
Yeah, so this movie really kicks into gear when Julie Andrews as the grandma shows up. And of course, we get some iconic moments. You know, they have tea at the consulate, and I think one of the most memorable moments of this film is when she finds out she's a princess. So, you know, like the, like, you are Princess of Genovia. Like,
Amelia, have you ever heard of Edouard Christophe Philippe Gerard Rinaldi?
No.
He was the Crown Prince of Genovia.
Hmm. What about him?
Edouard Christophe Philippe Gerard Rinaldi was your father.
Yeah, sure. My father was the Prince of Genovia.
Uh-huh, you're joking.
Why would I joke about something like that?
No, because if he's really a prince, then I...
Exactly. You're not just Amelia Thermopolis. You are Amelia Mignonette Thermopolis Rinaldi, Princess of Genovia.
Me? A princess? Shut up!
I beg your pardon. Shut up.
Your Majesty, in America, it doesn't always mean be quiet. Here it could mean, wow, gee whiz, golly wally.
Oh, I understand. Thank you. Nevertheless, you are the princess. And I am Queen Clarice Rinaldi.
Why on earth would you pick me to be your princess?
Since your father died, you are the natural heir to the throne of Genovia. That's our law.
Shut up, that whole thing.
And then the waiter guy comes in and goes, like, you know, could mean, like, you know, gee whiz, golly wally. And she's like, oh, okay, that's fine. She's not telling me to shut up. They do get to that really quickly. But I always find it funny that no one from Genovia has an accent. They all pretty much sound British. But the minute they start, you know, railing off their titles, they put on accents. And it always seems a bit like,
Yeah, it's weird because the Prime Minister. He's got an accent.
Everyone else is like British or American or.
Yeah, it's weird. The rival family has an accent.
Yes, they're sort of like awful, creepy, not very attractive. Other family. Yeah. They're trying to take over the throne.
I guess it's not something they want to invest in. And also they got Julie Andrews. They're not going to be like, okay, Julie Andrews, now learn an accent.
But they throw on European accents for that. But yeah, she sort of does the whole, have you heard of Philippe Christophe, whatever. And she's like, no, he sounds swell or whatever. But yeah, and then she just announces that, you know, you're a princess. And then she sort of goes like, you know, but I want to just be invisible. That's like my goal in life. Please don't make me be a princess. I'm really good, like, you know, two-hander between both of them. I think they both do a really good job in that scene.
Once she finds out she's a princess, especially on this watch, what struck you? What'd you like? Was there anything interesting or fun? Any fun bits?
Then it sort of goes into that not a fun bit, because then she's kind of angry at, like, her entire family for lying to her. It does get funnier kind of after that, because then they're trying to teach her sort of to walk properly, and she's sort of like glumping along.
So I love a good makeover scene, trust me.
Yeah.
But when we talk about them here, we kind of discuss sometimes how they can be a little bit dated, you know, or like, oh, conform. And that was one of my worries with this film. This is a classic makeover scene, you know, with that Italian guy and...
with Paolo.
So we begin, Principessa. In Paolo's hands, remember. You will be beautiful. You have a thicker hair, but like a wolf. He's all right. Do you wear contact lens?
Well, I have them, but I don't really like to wear them that much.
Now you do.
You broke my glasses.
You broke my brush. Gretchen, Hanger, attack! I
love your eyebrows. We'll call them Frida and Color. If Brooke Shields married the Groucho Marx, their child would have your eyebrows. You want to know a big secret?
Tell me.
The cucumber does nothing. This is something we make up.
Was in Gary Marshall films as well, that guy.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot this actor's name, but I remember him in a bunch of other ones. Just the comb breaking, you know, all that kind of stuff I remembered so much. Obviously, she does look very 2001 when she's made over, but she still almost looks like a different person, despite the changes being relatively subtle.
You know, she's had a straighten and a blowout and some makeup and no bushy eyebrows, but really they barely did anything really, but she just looks, I think, because annoyingly with makeovers they sort of have a different attitude afterwards. I don't know, like, I finally look beautiful on the outside of it, all of that. Makeover scenes are always a bit gross.
Cinematically they're fun, right? But then there's always the problematic nature of them. However, I was actually pleasantly surprised on this watch that after she's made over, it is a big deal to, like, her friend and to the people around her, like, are you being a different person? Are you selling out? Now, it's not like a huge deal because this is a G movie, but
yeah. They
do make it a point to say, like, are you a different person? I'm not so sure.
Yeah. And Lily gets, like, really mean about it because, I mean, the minute she sees her makeover, she goes, like, who destroyed you? You should sue. And she just, like, will not stop harping on about it. But then Mia finally, you know, goes, like, will you just, like, leave me alone for once? Like, you tell me what to do all the time. And then she goes, like, just because your hair sucks, get off mine. Lily is such a dick about that. Like, she's just keeps going on and on and on. And then, like, Mia sitting there, like, weeping in the car. Just, like, that bit. I always hate that bit. It's just, like, oh, just leave her alone.
They have, like, such a topsy-turvy friendship. It is, like, weird. But, you know, I think it's somewhat realistic. You do see a lot of friends like that. And just the fact that she, in terms of Mia, she's a princess. It's not like she's doing it just to get popular and conform, right? Like, she has to go to a ball and stuff. Not that I necessarily agree with it, but there are certain expectations of being a princess. You know, like, you can't look disheveled necessarily. Well, at least that's kind of the old-fashioned rules, right?
So you're going to be, you know, in the public eye all the time. They want you to sort of look your best, look as neat as you can. And
I think you're, like, neat is a key word, you know?
Yeah, just look a little bit. Don't have gross fingernails and just, you know, be a little bit more refined because you are royalty after all.
Now, it doesn't get too crazy, but it's a good lesson when she is outed by the stylist guy. And she has to deal with kind of that at school. We haven't seen that too much in the films we've talked about in terms of having to deal with fame in school.
Yeah, I think she deals with it well, even though it doesn't really seem to change. Like, half the time, the mean girls that all have similar names, which I hate. Did you become friends because you have the same name? But then they kind of half the time pretend to the media that they're friends, but then they still make fun of her. Like, when she sort of reveals, like, a new look to everyone, they all go, like, oh my god, look, he's trying to fit in now.
Lana, Anna, and Fontana.
Then they're, like, Lana and the Lynettes later on when Mandy Moore has a song.
Yeah, if this is going to be kind of like a kids' movie, I was totally cool with them because they're not great people and that's fine. You know, they're like bullies. Are they fleshed out characters? No.
No, they're Mean Girl 1, 2, and 3. They're really, like, no personality other than just to be mean.
But there is that pull, not necessarily from me in high school, but there is that pull for a lot of people to want to be popular. And especially Mia here, because she has a crush on Mandy Moore's boyfriend. He breaks up with Mandy Moore and invites her to the beach party.
So excited.
Which I kind of saw what Gary Marshall was doing here. He was kind of throwing back to, like, beach party movies of the 60s, which we talk about on this podcast, are, like, really the precursor to the teen movies that would come later. It almost kind of has, like, a 60s vibe. It shouldn't, but it does. But it makes it fun, you know?
Yeah. And, like, they add that bit kind of later on to add a bit of, like, before the whole princess decision, they add, like, an extra bit of, like, you know, drama, like, because then she has to keep canceling plans. But, like, I think before they get to that bit, she has her first, like, royal function, which I feel like that scene kind of feels like it's not in a teen movie anymore. And that bit feels like a straight up rom-com kind of thing, because she's just like completely awkward and tripping over and setting people on fire. And
yeah, that's when we first meet a lot of like the Genovians. They're, I don't know why they decided to have all their like Independence Day parties and welcome things in San Francisco, but hey, the queen's there. I guess it makes sense.
Bringing all of Genovia over and the pear juggler. They're famous for their pears.
Which apparently was a Julie Andrews suggestion, and that's not in the book.
I don't remember anything about pears.
Yeah, no, but that dinner is fun because it's a lot of like slapstick and gag humor.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things I read that was an interesting note, that when the, for lack of a better word, I don't remember his name, but like the drunk guy's arm is on fire.
Yeah.
It was supposed to go out, but it didn't. So Anne Hathaway improvised pouring the glass on it, which I thought was a great touch.
Yeah, and then I love at the end when she kind of turns around and goes like, was that my fault? And then the like waiter guys are going like, yeah, definitely. Yeah, sorry, no, that was definitely you. But at least then like, the Prime Minister and his wife kind of trying to help her out, because then she puts like the palate cleanser, but she puts like this massive scoop of like frozen sorbet in her mouth and then starts like freaking out. So they kind of at least do it with us, and then it kind of adds a little bit of funniness. So they're not just laughing at how awkward the new princess is.
Yeah, it was a fun scene. It was a funny scene. It was a colorful scene. Again, a very regal scene. You know, like the rival couples, a little bit silly and a little bit kiddish, but that's the kind of movie this is. Yeah, you know, so that was a cool scene as well. But the beach scene I wanted to bring up because, again, that's our little bit of like teenage danger.
And then it leads to, you know, awkwardness with her friends, because then she has to sort of, she forgets to cancel on Lily, because apparently everything is on this Saturday night. She wasn't going to go to the beach party, so then she's kind of going to go on Lily's cable show, because Lily's really into causes and saving the whales and save the otters, and so she kind of wants to have, you know, a princess on there, because she thinks maybe more people will watch and she'll be able to get her ideas out. But she kind of forgets to cancel on Lily, but she does cancel on Michael.
Yes, that was her other plans.
Kind of gotten up the courage to sort of go, hey, like, you know, do you want to come and watch my band and we can like work on your car and that? Because she has like a Mustang that is at the mechanics.
Yeah, so I was just going to mention that.
He's just so in love with Mia, but he hasn't told her.
No, yeah, I just want to mention the car. The car scenes are all cool in this film. You know, like you said, it's an older Mustang and Michael is the one repairing it. But I just have a call back to when Anne Hathaway tells Julie Andrews, like, oh, I want you to meet my baby. We already know it's the car, but just her look. Yeah, so again, she blows off Michael and his band playing at the garage.
It's just like that, but we don't find that out until a bit later.
Yeah, she blows off, what's her friend again?
Lily forgets to tell Lily, which instead she's just so excited about going to this beach party.
Is that where Mandy Moore sings the Stupid Cupid song, or is it another?
Well, here to tell us all about it, please welcome
Lana and the Lynettes.
Lana, Anna, and Fontana.
Stupid Cupid, you're a real mean guy. Stop picking on me.
Yeah, because for some reason the school puts on Mandy Moore as the entertainment for the beach party. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like a school beach party, because eventually we see
the
gym teacher, who's like a reoccurring character here. Like, she's the one who saves. But a stupid boyfriend guy is definitely like using Mia.
Because I think, I don't quite remember, but I feel like it's implied that he was the one that called people and they showed up, you know, at the party, and then he like pretends that they're hiding out in a shed, but then he brings her out the front and then kisses her so we can end up on the paper and all of that. And then she kind of obviously is really upset and her foot didn't pop, because that's like her thing.
Oh yeah, she has a very like idealistic mindset.
Your foot will pop like in old movies. But then that doesn't happen, so she's upset, and then like all the press show up and then he kisses her out the front. But like the girls then pretend that they're helping her, but then bring all the reporters over and then like whip the tent away while she's trying to get changed. Like, that bit just seems like way too mean.
Yeah, it's very mean. They're, you know, doubling down here. But I think they have to, and here's why, at least in my opinion. I think that if this was a PG-13 movie, even, this would have involved alcohol. This would have involved like a little bit more like illicit behavior.
Yeah.
And that's what have been captured. To me, this is like Disney's way of being like, oh, we need a kind of, she needs to look like she was kind of naked, you know, and she needs to look like she was, you know, back to a movie we both talked about, like Teen Witch. I'm glad they didn't do like that kind of intimate scene, you know, like.
I'm glad they didn't do anything like that.
But so this is like definitely tones it down from that and tones it down from like, I don't know, like a more mature movie.
Yeah.
But it does like push different buttons of like, oh my God, these people are so mean. And again, like I said, I think they had to do that because they needed to show conflict in different ways.
Yeah. And they needed to have sort of a way that Mia would kind of decide partway through the movie that she doesn't want to be a princess anymore. Because then Clarice gets really upset, even though she won't actually let Mia explain what happened, but she gets like really annoyed, and then Mia sort of goes, well, I don't want to disappoint you again, and I don't think it's for me, which she just seems really like mature in that she's kind of decided that she gets being a princess is a big deal, and she doesn't want to put that in jeopardy or make them like, you know, a laughing stock or anything. But so she kind of says that she won't be a princess anymore, so that's like extra drama in the lead up to, you know, the end of the film.
Yeah, because she feels like she's let people down. And again, she goes back to like, you know, maybe it was better just being ignored. This is a funny movie that it's 2 hours because, again, not that much happens.
Yeah, probably some of the middle could have been.
I mean, I didn't feel like it dragged or anything like that. I was just kind of surprised on the time. She makes up with Lily, right? Like she apologizes.
And then Lily apologizes and says, like, I'm sorry, I've been so awful, but actually I was kind of really excited and I wanted you to be a princess because it means you can have the power to like change things and get your idea. And Lily just obviously is desperate to make a change in the world, but no one is listening because she's a 15-year-old girl. So
yeah, I love she says, I just found out my cable show reaches 12 people. Like, very podcast-like, in my opinion.
So then she invites Lily to go to the ball with her as her sort of, you know, way to make up for maybe being a bad friend for a little bit. But
yeah, so I was going to mention that there's a lot of scenes that maybe they're not necessary. But again, like I said, I don't mind them because they just create like cool moments. She has some revenge moments. Like one of them is when she puts the ice cream on Mandy Moore's.
I love that bit.
Cheerleading outfit.
Mandy Moore just like is really mean just for no reason. Making fun of Lily's kind of boyfriend-ish guy, Jeremiah. And then they're like laughing at his hair. And
oh, I forgot about Jeremiah.
That jumper was probably like, it's hideous, but it was probably really expensive because it looks like, you know, a high quality sort of knit. It's very ugly, but like, I think obviously Jeremiah has like a lot of money because he's always talking about like stocks and like, I think he's just some like tech genius.
What an interesting character, right? He's a magician who's also like a stock genius and who's rich. Like,
and yeah, he kind of just like keeps popping up, and I feel like he kind of likes Lily the whole time, but she thinks he's an idiot until kind of later, and then they are kind of a couple, I think. But yeah, like Mia's just trying to sit in the courtyard, like completely, yeah, teasing them. So then Mia, which I think this bit is hilarious, just gets up and goes like, I just really love like your cheerleading uniform, like it's just so cute. But then she just, even though I don't know why they have ice cream at school, that's pretty awesome, but
private school.
Oh yeah. But then she sort of goes over and yeah, completely just like mushes this ice cream and all the sprinkles just completely into the front of her uniform. And then for some reason, someone just starts the chant of like, Lana got coned. And then Lily's doing it like on a loudspeaker going like, Lana got coned. And then Lana has a complete flip out because all of a sudden people are laughing at her. And then even the teachers, which they probably wouldn't because teachers aren't really allowed to do that. But
really quickly, just to backtrack a little, like at the beach party, did you notice that Josh's boat is called the Josher?
Oh, that is so awful. He is a complete ween.
Yeah. It's interesting that she gets a lot of her revenge in this, like, baseball scene that happens.
Because that's been, like, a recurring scene the whole film. Like, just pass her and just, like, everyone just move on. Because obviously she can't play baseball and that's fine. But the teacher keeps trying to just, like, you know, come on, we're going to make you be good at sport because I don't want you to fail. And then there's a bit they're all kicking, like, soccer balls at her. Like, that's a great way to, you know, learn hand-eye coordination. But yeah, she finally, you know, gets her revenge because she, I think because she's just completely over stupid Josh by now because he's a complete dick. Then he is making fun of her again. So then she just magically becomes amazing at baseball and yeah, hits this amazing ball and gets him in the ball, I guess. but yeah.
Again, I don't know if it was 100% on purpose, but it is satisfying. That was one word that I really wrote down for this film. Again, I know it's not like, you know, I recently talked about Dazed and Confused, very different film to this. There are a lot of like more adult subject matters, and this is largely a family movie, you know, but it is very, very satisfying at certain moments.
Yeah.
Before we get to like the big emotional ending and all that, throughout the film, as soon as she's known, we're starting to see this like her dealing with fame in terms of stuff like the paparazzi, for example. Just to go back to that beach scene, really creepy that they're trying to take naked pictures of a 15-year-old.
Yeah, I know. Like, excuse me, everyone. It's been like 2 weeks and now all of a sudden we want like, you know, the people want more. They want like, you know, drama. They want scandal.
Yeah, I mean, there's also just when she has the whole angle of going out with her grandmother, you know, just driving around San Francisco and such, and the car ends up breaking down and they slide into that trolley.
That bit's hilarious.
It's a great bit, and it's also though like the crowds surrounding her, and I just love, it's so simple, but Mia, she doesn't know how to deal with the fame on the press or just like crowds essentially, but the way that you know, Julia Andrews' character, the queen, can just snap into it and know exactly what to say to get out of that situation,
a complete pro at it. So then she just on the spot invents this sort of special award thing and like bestows the Order of the Rose on the Mia, like pulls like the handbrake out of the car because that's come out. So then she uses like that to like, you know, I dub the thing of the rose. And I love how they leave and then she goes like, you know, goodbye trolley people. And
yeah, and I was just gonna say, it goes back to her lesson, and her lessons seem at first like rigid and stuck up, and you know, like there's the one where she ties Mia to the chair with the scarf.
Yeah.
Or those great like, you know, how to walk scenes, how to eat scenes, how to do everything.
Yeah, they become like really fun, those scenes.
They're fun bits. And this watch, I don't know if I remembered it in original watches, but certainly on this watch, I was really struck by some subtle line she puts in, how she's not royalty technically. She married into royalty. So you have to imagine that she went through all of this herself. Sorry, the queen, I mean. You know, the queen went through all this herself. So there's like kind of like a little relation there. And we get a lot of moments later, right? Like when she gets angry at Mia, obviously, for doing that whole, the beach thing. And Joe kind of says like, not, he didn't say exactly this, but like, you might not have been harsh as a queen, but you're kind of harsh as her grandmother. And in those moments, there's a lot of heart in the film. Like I don't have children, but like, this is a film I would definitely have my children watch and be like, you're probably going to enjoy this. This is a good movie.
Yeah, definitely. And it's good for parents and kids. Like, if you had to watch it with your kids, you wouldn't be like, ugh. It's got something for everyone. Yeah.
It's a true family movie. But again,
yeah.
I think it's watchable, at least more watchable for adults.
Yeah.
Because of the great performances, though. Like, if you just had anybody in these roles, it might be kind of a corny script, especially if people were playing it a little bit over the top. You know, like, I'm the queen, you know. Like,
you know, the Christmas Prince on Netflix.
Yeah, I didn't want to mention it by name, but yeah, you know.
It would be like, you know, all of those films that now Netflix makes a million films with made up European principalities, all of that kind of stuff. Like, but yeah, this, because of the cast and the performances and the way the film is made, it definitely elevates it to like a, you know, a, something you'd want to watch, you know, more than once.
Yeah, no, in so many ways. Let's get to our big ending, right? So as you mentioned, Mia has said she doesn't want to be a princess, and her grandmother has a really good line where she says something along the lines of like, you know, still come to the ball. You know, she's disappointed. Everyone's a little disappointed, but she's like, you're still family. You're still going to be invited to these things.
Like, you know, I have faith in you and I actually feel like you would have been a really good princess. But then she has to renounce her title, which then Mia completely freaks out because it means public speaking. She kind of decides to run away, driving to Colorado by herself. Like, and she doesn't have a license.
No, and her car doesn't work that well, despite her keep trusting the same mechanic, but whatever.
It's just too far gone, and the mechanics are doing their best, but it's just, like, you know, I think it's had its time.
But this great big ball, again, everything looks beautiful and very, like, princess-y. But she has a convertible, the car's a convertible, and she goes out in the rain, it breaks down, so she's all wet. But realizes that, you know, she realizes that she actually does want to be a princess because of a letter she discovers from her dad. And that was like a nice touching moment. Obviously her dad has passed away, and obviously it's not like a message from the grave, but it was written for her 16th birthday, which is coming up. And there's a nice little quote in there. And because of that, Joe is one of the first to realize that she probably ran away. He goes and finds her in his cool limo. Brings her to the party, and if I sound like I'm rushing, I'm sorry, but the reason I'm rushing is because when she gets to the party, and maybe I'm just emotional these days, but I was really affected by her final speech. I thought it was like such a heartwarming moment. It's so true and real. It didn't sound regal, but it also didn't sound like someone who was shy and reserved. Like, just the fact of like duty and realizing that all she can do in this position, and it was like, oh my god, like I was getting a little misty-eyed.
Hi, hello, I'm Mia. It stopped raining.
Get your tiara, Daddy.
I'm really no good at speech making. Normally I get so nervous that I faint or run away, or sometimes I even get sick. Come on. But you really didn't need to know that. But I'm not so afraid anymore. No, my father helped me. Earlier this evening, I had every intention of giving up my claim to the throne. And my mother helped me by telling me that it was okay and by supporting me like she has for my entire life. But then I wondered how I'd feel after abdicating my role as Princess of Genovia. Would I feel relieved? Or would I feel sad? And then I realized how many stupid times a day I use the word I. In fact, probably all I ever do is think about myself. And how lame is that when there's like 7 billion other people out there on the planet? And when... Sorry, I'm going too fast. But then I thought, if I cared about the other 7 billion out there instead of just me, that's probably a much better use of my time. See, if I were Princess of Genovia, then my thoughts and the thoughts of people smarter than me would be much better heard, and just maybe those thoughts could be turned into actions. So this morning when I woke up, I was Mia Thermopolis. But now, I choose to be forevermore Amelia Mionette Thermopolis Rinaldi, Princess of Genovia.
And realizes that, yes, I might, you know, be a bit scared. That's, you know, think of all that, the good that I could do. Because then she kind of starts her speech going, it's stupid how many times a day I say the word I. And then she just decides that she'd actually be really disappointed if she just, because she was scared, just, you know, gave it all up.
And my favorite part is that she's just, like, I forgot what she's wearing, but she's got, like, the wet hair. She's just in casual clothes, and she's out from the rain. And, like, the reporter's like, oh, she's sporting a grunge look, you know? Like,
with, like, you know, jeans and docks. And it's like, oh, my God. Yeah, she's kind of a complete mess. I think by the end, people don't even notice what she looks like anymore because she's saying this, like, amazing...
Yeah, it was a really great speech.
You know, just... And then she sort of ends it. She then puts on the accent because she does the, you know, this morning I was Mia Thermopolis, but now I choose to be forevermore Amelia Mignonette Thermopolis Rinaldi of Genovia.
Yeah.
And then they rush Paolo in and he, like, you know, pitches her up for the ball because obviously she can't go out on the dance floor looking like that.
No, and she looks, you know, she's in this great gown and she looks elegant. And
it's her first tiara that Clarissa's like, this was my first tiara and it was always my favorite. So she, you know. So even then, she was obviously still just hoping that she'd finally decide and go, yes, I'll be the princess.
When you go through Anne Hathaway's career, you can't not talk about this film, not just because it's her first one, but it's definitely one of her more iconic performances. What did she win an Oscar for? Les Miserables, I think? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was that.
I didn't see it. I mean, you know, to me, it's like this, Devil Wears Prada. She's had a couple things where she really, like, stands out. But it all started here. And it's just from her naturalistic performance that... It's a silly Disney movie, let's be honest, but she's able to, again, draw me in, and this speech does it. Like, the speech is the reason why, as silly as it sounds, you know. I'm sure some of my hardcore listeners are listening and be like, Brian, you got emotional at that? I'm like, I'm sorry, I did. I got into this film.
You know, I don't have to apologize for it. It's a good film. She just seems really natural and kind of real and heartfelt in her performance. So you just kind of, you know, and everyone can... find something in her performance that kind of speaks.
For sure. And we, you know, we end with dancing. The Queen's dancing with the Prime Minister. She's kind of looking for a partner. And Michael, who she invited,
which
is there.
Seems like really awkward. Like, because obviously the press secretary, like Charlotte, who's kind of the assistant, probably would have checked whether Mia had a date or not. But that bit seems really like they should have like had someone on standby to dance with Mia, because we've now just announced her as a princess, and she's now just like standing,
like looking around. Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, some diplomat. Yeah.
Or then like the Prime Minister could then dance with her as well, and then someone else could dance with Clarice. But
yeah, you would think. And then I thought Joe was gonna dance with, and then the Prime Minister, you know, like there was a bunch of, it was a little awkward.
But then yes, Michael kind of appears, because she, in an attempt to kind of make up with him for cancelling, she invites him to the ball, but strolls in, you know, dances with her at the ball, and then they finally have a little chat out in the garden. We never really see that transition, but now all of a sudden, because she doesn't have a thing for Josh anymore, she's sort of in the background, as obviously realised that Michael likes her and she likes him as well. He's a much better choice, obviously.
He is, but look, I like Robert Schwartzman. I mean, he seems like a nice guy. I do like the character, but it was in this scene.
Yeah, it did. This bit feels like a tiny bit rushed, because it's sort of up until now, we kind of don't know that Mia likes him.
No, exactly. And he doesn't seem, I'm not dissing him, because again, I know I mentioned like this was his last true film role, but apparently in the last couple years, he's dabbled into acting again and doing some other stuff, but who knows. But so again, this is not personal Robert Schwartzman, if you're listening. But I do feel like in that scene, he seems like he doesn't want to be there.
But transition, that then it's sort of like the whole film, he's been really into me and she hasn't reciprocated because she didn't realize. But then it's kind of like he goes like, why me? And she's like, because you saw me when I was invisible. But that kind of line always seems a bit odd, because up until then, she hasn't really noticed that he noticed her. A big thing in the book. It's actually reversed, because in the books, for after the Josh thing in the first book, for about the next 4 books after that, Mia's got like a massive crush on Michael, but he doesn't know and he doesn't notice, because she's just Lily's best friend. And then they kind of eventually get together, but then I think they stayed together for the rest of the book. So it was, they obviously wanted to throw that in because it's a big part of the story. But yeah, it just kind of, I wish they'd given, because they gave a lot of other things lots of time in the middle, I wish they'd kind of had at least one other scene between the, like, them having an argument kind of thing and then the ball.
Yeah, and, I mean, you can tell me about it a little bit later, but I feel like that's the one thing missing from a traditional princess story, like the quote-unquote Prince Charming. I'm fine with it, but he's, like, almost like a hipster before there were hipsters. He's, like, almost like a I care, but I don't care kind of thing.
Too cool.
Of course, Joe dances with the Queen, as we mentioned, which is nice. And then it breaks out just like a fun dance party to that, like, Miracles Happen song.
Yeah.
I read, while doing my research, that they actually played Madonna's Like a Prayer during this scene, and they're just like, dance and have fun. Apparently, you could actually see people mouthing Like a Prayer in the background. And again, that's not the ending, because I liked how they had this little coda, right? Like, she's on the plane talking about, like,
what's going to happen next.
What's going to happen. And you see Genovia, which is just like England or something. But, you know, like, it's still cool, though.
Yeah, and she finally sees a palace. And then she's sort of just like, we're going to be moving to Genovia, which doesn't happen in the books. They stay living in New York. And then just in the summers, she goes to Genovia for princess stuff. But
oh, that's interesting.
So the time she just is still in New York, going to school, doing her thing. She still has princess lessons. But yeah, this was a nice like way to tie off the film. That's kind of like, you know, she's moving to Genovia. She's going to be a princess. Like, you know, Lily and Michael are going to visit. And she's taking a Stang with her, which she'll be allowed to drive finally because she'll be 16.
Yeah, and also she's a princess, so I'm sure.
Yeah. They have different license rules in Genovia, apparently. So,
so before we like talk about some awards and the ratings and all that, tell me quickly, because you said you've seen the sequel. Was the sequel enjoyable? Do you think it was faithful to this?
I liked the sequel. It definitely wasn't faithful to the books, because they kind of, because in the sequel, at the very beginning, like, you never see Michael again, and she's on a plane again doing, like, a voiceover. I think it's more the voiceovers because she's writing in her diary, you know, the princess diaries, so it's got to be a diary. But she kind of goes like, you know, oh, you know, we're just friends now, and I remember when the next book after the sequel came out, Meg Cabot wrote in a bit that Mia was like, I don't know why they wrote him out of the film because we're still together. But yeah, the sequel kind of is, it's directed by Gary Marshall again, but this one's like full on rom-com everything. Like she's back to kind of being, even though she's a bit more refined, she's back to being like awkward and falling over, and there's like a new romance with Chris Pine. Who is in the, that was one of his first films, I think.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, I think there's like a, well, they invent some other drama that now she sort of won't be eligible to take over as queen unless she gets married within 30 days. So that's kind of the plot of that. So it's like full on rom-com. They're trying to find her a husband. Completely like departs from the books, but it does kind of, it matches with this film at least because of the whole Gary Marshall feel, but I don't enjoy it quite as much, but it's still a good, it's all right, but yeah.
There's been a lot of rumors about Princess Diaries 3. Who knows if we're ever getting that, but I'm not sure what it would be, but that'd be interesting as well. I don't think you've been on since I've had these awards, maybe? I don't know.
No, I don't think I have.
Okay, so the first award is the Wooderson Award. It's named after Matthew McConaughey's character in Dazed and Confused, and in that film, he was only supposed to be in like a couple scenes, but the director loved him so much that he added him to more and more stuff. And of course, Matthew McConaughey today is very famous and very successful. So the award is for a character who you would have liked to see more of in this film. Is there anyone who they didn't focus on enough that you wanted to see a little bit more of?
I don't know, because I feel like I was going to say maybe a bit more of kind of Joe, but I don't really know where that would fit. So I feel like maybe he probably was in it enough.
It's hard to say, right? But like, I think Joe might have just like given the award to himself already, because again, he was just supposed to be a driver and he built himself a romance story, so so maybe a little bit more of Joe, but he did a good job on his own for that one. All right, the Long Duk Dong Award. Again, we know all about Long Duk Dong, but it's a character whose omission would make the film better. Who, whether it be racial insensitivity or not, I don't think we have that here, but is there anyone you would delete from the film to make it better?
Maybe just some of the mean girls. I don't know. I feel like they're a bit... I feel like we could have just had one mean girl. I don't think we needed Anna and Fontana or whatever, but...
No, but you need that... I think you need the classic group, you know? It's not Mean Girl, the movie. It's Mean Girls.
I mean... Maybe it didn't need the next door neighbor.
Oh, Mr. Robitussin. I actually liked him. I forgot. We didn't talk about him because he was funny because he kept like writing the screenplay or like it was a soap opera.
I feel like I've seen him pop up in other films. Yeah, he's kind of just like a weird interlude. Like he's writing his little sitcom over there. But
you know who I would nominate for this? And not because of the actor or anything like that, but like how the mom starts dating the teacher, but we don't really get much of it in the film. There's no like awkwardness. It's just like, oh, don't date my teacher. Okay. But I'm going to date him, you know?
Because in the books, they get married and then they have a kid. So it's kind of, I think they wanted to just throw that in. But yeah, I feel like in the context of the film, I don't really think it needed to be there.
No. Yeah. That was a little bit weird.
Gotten rid of that teacher or just had him as like a nameless teacher of leading debate or whatever.
Yeah.
Mr. O'Connell or whatever his name is, which is different in the book, I think.
I mean, just to go back to the last award, speaking of the school, maybe we need a little bit more of Sandra Oh and a little bit less of him.
Yes, because she was great. I think she could have done with a few more scenes.
Yeah, that would have been cool. Okay, Cameron Frye Award, and this is famously Alan Ruck was 30 years old when he played Cameron Fry in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. So was there any...
He kind of seems believable as a teen, which is weird, but...
He definitely seems believable, but...
Wow, he's too old, of course.
Was there anyone who you felt was too old to be a high schooler?
No, I feel like they all seemed pretty legit. Like, I think even if maybe they weren't the right age, they all looked kind of young-looking. So I feel like they got a pass on that. I don't think anyone looked too old.
I was just looking up their ages quick. I think we've even talked about some films where, you know, there's like a hunky guy, but he's got a 5 o'clock shadow. Like, again, Teen Witch. Like, that guy doesn't look like he's in high school.
Yeah, no, he definitely doesn't. 12 o'clock shadow, because, like, I don't know. That makes him just sound really old. Yeah, I feel like they all looked, even if they weren't, they all looked for
it. Looking at it now, like, at least Michael, Lily, and Mia were actually all the same age.
Yeah.
And they were all teenagers, so.
And I think all the others kind of just looked.
Yeah, Mandy Moore was the same age. Like, so they actually strangely casted very well in terms of age. Yeah, even Mandy Moore's boyfriend or whatever was literally the same age. Like, it's amazing. Rarely do they do that well in films, but they did it here. So good for them. So really no one can get that award. But
because it's Disney, I think, because they always have. Sometimes Disney go a bit older, but they often, like, all their shows and stuff. Like, I feel like High School Musical, except for a couple, they were all pretty much.
Yeah, that's a good point. And again, this is a family movie, but they're definitely trying to target people who are younger than high school here. So they're not, I don't want to put it like this, but kind of, like, they're not, like, picking people who they want to, like, over-sexualize, you know?
Yeah, because they want little kids. Like, I mean, I was 11, so they seemed, like, really old to me, but... But obviously now you watch it and go, no, I think they just, you know, they seem teen.
It wasn't like American Pie, like, oh, I want to see this girl take her shirt off, you know, like that kind of thing. Like, that's nothing to do with this movie, which is fine, which is good, but, I, you know, that kind of like cracks the case a little bit in terms of in casting, like, why do they sometimes cast older people? And sometimes it's that, like, oh, I want this guy to be a heartthrob to everyone. But here it's just like, let's just make, you know, high schoolers, which is nice.
Mm.
So the critics did not like this film. 48% by the critics, 68% by the audience, which seems kind of low even by the audience. But like I said, it was a surprise hit. Some critics liked it, but a lot of critics put it on their worst movies of the year list, which is weird.
Oh, it's not, you know, serious and Oscar worthy. It's like trash, but everyone is trying to win Oscars.
Exactly. There's a definite niche for a film like this. And if you compare it to other Gary Marshall films we get later, like you said, Valentine's Day or Mother's Day, this is much more watchable, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, those films, they're not amazing, but they're like, they're not really meant to be. They're just...
No.
I think it's just that, maybe it's because Gary Marshall directed it and he's known for rom-coms and critics are always like, you know, oh my God, it's got romance, blah. Like, you know, critics don't really enjoy rom-coms. You know, they would discount them as like rubbish. So that was probably part of that with this film. But the target market didn't care. We enjoyed it.
No, and clearly people spoke in terms of how much money it made, but also... In Anne Hathaway's career, she was super hot after this. She got a lot of roles. You know, she ends up transitioning to a lot of adult roles. She wasn't just like a teen star stuck in that mold, you know? Like, she could have done like Ella Enchanted movies her whole life, or at least...
But she kind of quickly, she did Ella Enchanted and then sort of quickly moved out of that. I feel like the next thing she did after like teen stuff was Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, and that's
definitely not... Mia Thermopolis, Ella Enchanted role, because like it's definitely like, okay, Anne Hathaway is doing films for adults now, like, you know. But she, you know, transitioned almost right away into great roles and now has won an Oscar and still doing great stuff. Like,
yeah, so I mean, like, again, the legacy of this film is Anne Hathaway in my mind. It's a great film to watch, especially in a family, but this has become Julie Andrews, of course, but this is not Julie Andrews' legacy, you know?
She already had that, so this is just, you know, added on to that. But.
Absolutely. So from an A+ to F scale, what will you grade The Princess Diaries?
I think I might give it... probably like a B plus, but like lots of pluses that it's nearly an A minus. It's that kind of, I think it's that kind of range.
Yeah. So I gave it a B. I think it's a fun movie. I think it's a rewatchable movie. Is the crowd who are into like zombie films and people's heads being cut off going to be into this movie? Maybe not.
Films can't be for everyone.
No, yeah, this is a weird podcast because there's so many genres we discuss on this podcast, you know, and this is certainly more again in like the family movie, teen movie kind of thing. This is very inoffensive film, but it's a fun film, and again, like I'll say it a million times, the performances carry it from made for TV or today a streaming movie,
yeah,
to actually like a hit in my mind. So Princess Diaries sleeping bag, any ideas for what that one, you want that to look like?
Maybe I'll go with like a sort of, you know, silver one, you know, royalty tiaras, that kind of thing. I'll maybe have just like a silver glittery sleeping bag.
Oh, that's cool. I think I'll have one that has like Genovian pears on it.
Ah, of course, that would be very cool.
Anything else you want to mention about Princess Diaries?
No, I think we've kind of, you know, covered all of that.
So you and I were having this slumber party. We're having a good time. We're watching Princess Diaries, but of course we rented Princess Diaries. That's our free movie. What's our two other movies we're gonna watch on this awesome slumber party we're having?
I feel like they'd still have to be, I feel like this kind of style of film. We have to be, you know, some sort of family friendly teen kind of style. What would it be? Or we could kind of just throw in like a classic. We could probably watch Clueless afterwards.
I think we should pick Ella Enchanted because Anne Hathaway's in it, and you know, what's her name, Kiwi Smith helped write it, and she wrote 10 Things I Hate About You. I think it fits in well.
Definitely. And we could skip Clueless because it's a classic, but maybe it doesn't kind of fit in. Yeah.
Well, we could just watch the sequel.
Yeah. All right, we'll do that. We'll throw Anne Hathaway triple feature and we'll end it with the sequel.
Sounds good to me. That works. Well, it's always a pleasure, Shani, and we'll have you back soon. So where can people follow you?
Well, you can just follow me on Twitter as usual. I'm just at Shawnee Mead. I probably just, I feel like I'm tweeting a bit more than usual because I'm obviously watching a lot more film. Yeah. There'll be a lot of, you know, stuff of what I'm watching and a lot of GIFs, that kind of thing. But
you certainly enjoy your GIFs, as do I, as do I. I think it's so fascinating that in our history right now, in our internet history, like GIFs are, they're just so perfect, right? Because like, it's not a movie. Like you don't have to send someone a whole video because that's like, could be too long or has noise, you know? But it's better than a picture, so it's like the perfect thing you could send to someone to express a moment.
And because there's so many, you can just, I can always pretty much find a specific GIF that I want. And if I can think of like a movie scene that goes like, oh, this is the perfect answer to that thing someone's just said, but I can't say anything that eloquent myself, so here's a GIF. I'm like searching. I won't often put in a lot of like search categories in Giphy because I want something specific. I don't like to just get what's on the first page. I like to, you know, sometimes you don't even have to answer yourself, you just send a GIF and it's like perfect. Exactly what I wanted to say, but it's already been said by someone else.
Well, Godspeed all the GIF makers out there, so that's for sure.
We appreciate you and you should be paid, but yeah, that's not a thing yet.
It's a thankless job. Well,
yeah,
I will thank you though for being on the podcast as always. Thank you so much, Shani,
and thank you for having me back. And it's been good fun. It's been a nice distraction. Yeah.
Miracles happen once in your life when you believe.
Sorry, that song's in my head now. I got into this movie. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, but it was awesome. And it was awesome having Shawnee on, despite, you know, the distance between us. We could always have a good conversation and we could always relate to the high school films that we happen to be talking about. And that's what High School Slumber Party is all about, guys. Thank you so much every week, or bi-weekly now, for tuning in. I really appreciate it. It's given me some focus during this difficult time period. It's given me something to do, and it's been pretty awesome. So, you know, Slumbers, you are everything to me. You are my princesses, all of you. You are my princesses of Genovia. I knight you that, or whatever it is. Maybe I'm going crazy. I don't know. Anyway, homework for next week. Very, very important, guys. And when I say next week, remember, not next Friday, next Monday. But you're going to watch a little film called Flying. Here's the trailer. Couldn't seem to find a trailer. That's odd. Oh, I guess it has an alternate title. You're going to watch a little film called Dream to Believe. Nothing came up for that trailer either. That's odd. Oh, I guess there's another title for this movie. You're going to watch a trailer for a film called Teenage Dream. No trailer there either. That's odd. You know what? The whole movie's on YouTube. Search any of those titles. You'll find it. It's one of Keanu Reeves' first films. And this is kind of a callback to another show on the Cage Club Podcast Network. One of the original shows, Keanu Club, which was the Keanu Reeves podcast, of course. So you have some extra homework. Not only are you going to watch this film, which is available everywhere because I believe it's in the public domain, but you're also going to listen to the episode of Keanu Club on Flying, aka Teenage Dream, aka Dream to Believe. And we're going to bring back the originals from that episode. That's right, the Godfather himself, Joey Lewandowski, resident historian, the man who's been on this podcast so many times, the super senior, Mike Manzi, will be here. And we have another returning guest from Wistful Thinking. That's Jordan Poland Clark. Recently celebrated a birthday, by the way, so wish her happy birthday. That gang will be here, and we're going to talk Flying. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be crazy. Definitely watch that. Definitely do your homework. And definitely tune in on Monday for our chat. So without a trailer, I guess I got to leave you with another song from the Princess Diaries soundtrack. And that song is by Crystal Harris. It's called Supergirl. And remember, guys, life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop to look around once in a while, you might miss it. Later, dudes.
Sometimes I have dreams. I picture myself flying above the clouds. Sky, conquering the world with my magic piano, never being scared, but then I realize I'm Supergirl, and I'm here to save the world, but I don't wanna know who's gonna save me. I'm a Supergirl, and I'm here to save the world.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.